Hello, and welcome to Community Conversations. These are pre-recorded interviews brought to you each Tuesday and Thursday at 8 a.m. on KRFY. Because of ongoing concerns about the COVID pandemic, we are not able to be in the studio doing live broadcast interviews right now. But we are still dedicated to recording and bringing to you topics of local and current interest, highlighting voices from our community. For Community Conversations, we are using phones and web-based technology so that participants can be recorded remotely. Please bear with us if there are any gaps or hiccups that might be caused by a slow or unstable phone or internet connection. Also, keep in mind that because these interviews are recorded, information may change between the time of this recording and the time that you hear it broadcast. Thank you for joining us for today's Community Conversation on KRFY 88.5 FM, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. Now grab a cup of coffee, sit back and enjoy some more of Adventure Number 8 by Jim Chappelle, and then we'll get on with today's show. Good morning, and welcome to today's Community Conversations, hosted by myself, Phil Huff, and my co-host, Julie Calamine. Good morning, Julie.
Well, good morning, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. Happy that it's July, and by the time this is played, we'll just come through the 4th.
That's true, and I'm happy to see you via Zoom, and I see you wearing a delightful orange face mask, so thank you. I appreciate that.
Yes, I think, you know, as a public service notice, cases on the rise in many rural areas, including Bonner County, and a good time to remind folks that wearing a mask is a good, safe thing to do.
And so, I agree. Thumbs up.
Yes, and one of the things that this COVID pandemic has done is it's shifted the way that we meet, and we're going to be talking today with a couple people who have been engaged with the Panhandle Forest Collaborative, and we'll talk about some upcoming meetings and how things have shifted in the time of COVID for the work that the Collaborative does. So that's today's topic, collaboration and the Panhandle Forest Collaborative. And with us, we have Ben Erie, Conservation Connect Program Manager for the National Forest Foundation. He's also the facilitator of the Panhandle Forest Collaborative. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Phil. Good morning, Julie.
And we have Liz Johnson-Gephardt, who's been on the show before. She's the executive director of the Priest Community Forest Connection. Today, she's here in the capacity as a co-chair and one of the founding members of the Panhandle Forest Collaborative. Good morning, Liz.
Good morning, everyone. Glad to be here.
So why don't we, before we launch into all things collaborative, tell us a little bit about yourselves and what you do for your organizations and how that led you to be working with the Panhandle Forest Collaborative. And Liz, why don't we start with you?
Sure, sounds good. I started working on forest projects with a citizen-based group here in Priest River in the year of 2000. We implemented one of the first stewardship contracts in the United States. It was held over about 6 years. And that group basically morphed into the Priest Community Forest Connection. I'm the executive director of the PCFC, and I've been doing that for about 15 years. This is a nonprofit. We're based in Priest River, and typically we work on different restoration and revitalization projects. Sometimes with the Forest Service, sometimes with Idaho Department of Lands, sometimes with Department of Environmental Quality, different cities, different counties. So it's kind of widespread, and which makes my job super interesting. I worked with the National Forest Foundation for about 15 years as well. And I started working with folks on forming the Panhandle Forest Collaborative about 10 years ago. I also work with the National Collaboration Cadre.
Wow, that's a lot of collaborations. And Liz, I was reading up a bit before we started, and it sounds like your collaborative anyway started from a point of sort of a despondent group of people that weren't happy with what was happening with forests and recreation and economies around the Priest River area, and really got together and did some good work.
Yes, I think you said that perfectly, Julie. Yes.
Ed, tell us about your work with the National Forest Foundation, what all you do and how you came to be engaged with the PFC.
Yeah, well, the National Forest Foundation is a congressionally chartered nonprofit. We're often thought of as the Forest Service's nonprofit partner. We are not the Forest Service, but we assist the Forest Service in many aspects of their mission. Basically, we try to work on behalf of the American public to engage the public in personal and meaningful connections to our national forests. We do that through leveraging private and public funding, and to use that to lead conservation efforts and promote responsible recreation. And we also do things like this, facilitate common ground amongst citizens of various towns and cities that surround our national forests.
Mm-hmm. And Ben, in reading about your group, I was connecting it with the Forest Service and found myself thinking, why do we need an additional nonprofit to help and engage people? And, you know, from year to year, I get a little email from you all asking me how many trees I would like to purchase for $1 per tree to plant in the national forest. And so tell us a little bit more about why you're an important group rather than just having a National Forest Service.
Sure. Well, that is a good question. For one thing, the Forest Service can't take direct donations and then apply that to the conservation of our national forest system. So that's a major role that the National Forest Foundation plays. We also have a granting out component of our work where we actually get congressional appropriations and then we use that through a one-to-one matching grant program to support our other nonprofit partners that do good conservation work on our national forest lands.
Okay, you are important. Why don't you each tell us how you got involved in the work you're doing? Tim, you go, or Ben, go ahead, please.
Yeah, one important component of the National Forest Foundation is that we're a non-advocacy organization. And as the Forest Service's nonprofit partner, and being non-advocacy, we're kind of put in a neutral position by default. So that served us really well when we're working with collaborative groups like the Panhandle Forest Collaborative. We don't have a stake in the decisions that are made on the collaborative group. We're just there to facilitate the conversation and facilitate people engaging in national forest management.
It's very important work, and it's always interesting to find out a little bit about the individuals and how they came to the jobs they're doing, where their interests and education and backgrounds led them to. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Ben.
Yeah, I'm originally a native of Kansas City, Kansas. I moved out to Montana to pursue my undergraduate education. Grew up vacationing in the Colorado Rockies, and knew I was Rockies bound when I graduated high school, and actually was pursuing a career that would get me outside as much as possible. So after graduating college, I spent about a decade on trail crews and as a wilderness ranger throughout the Northern Rockies, both in Idaho and Montana. And then when I needed to take my career a little bit more seriously, I returned to grad school and here at the University of Montana in Missoula, and pursued a degree in kind of the natural resource management social sciences. So basically how people work together and how we can efficiently use our natural resources for the greatest good, for the greatest number over the longest run.
Very nice.
Well, that explains your Zoom. That explains your Zoom background. It looks like a beautiful alpine meadow. We love it with the sun rising. Liz, how did you become involved in collaboratives such as these? What's your background?
Well, first, I'm jealous of Ben's background. It looks great on the Zoom there. I actually am originally from Minnesota, and I moved out here after my third college to finish college in Washington, and I met the man of my life, and we moved to a mountain here in Priest River, Idaho. It's about 5-6 miles out of town. We've lived off the grid for about 37, 38 years, and we have about 140 acres of forest land, and many years ago, I decided something was going wrong with my forest. I didn't really know what was going on. I wasn't very forest educated. And I talked to some folks here in Priest River, and they came up and kind of started educating me about forest management. I was especially interested in wildlife habitat and fresh water, etc. One of these persons is actually on the Panhandle Forest Collaborative. He is the one that got me started on what we called ourselves the Stewardship Advisory Committee, and that was the stewardship contract we had called Lake-Based Lamb up at Priest Lake. And boy, I guess that's it. I've been here ever since, and I just absolutely love this. I live the forest. It's part of my soul, and it means something to all of us around here, and I like to keep that energized.
That personal passion is a great segue, because I think it'll be part of the answer to the question of, so how did the Panhandle Forest Collaborative get started? What's its origin story?
Do you want me to take that, Phil?
Yes. Why don't you take that, Liz?
Sure. Okay. So about 10 or so years ago, our congressional representative at the time thought that he should maybe get some of the different factions in North Idaho who are or wanted to be involved with forest-related issues. We started out as a humongous group. I think there might have been 70 or so that gathered. Some were very experienced in collaboration, and others didn't have a clue. So, and I think maybe I was one of those. But we floundered around for several years, and Phil, you know this because you were there from day one. But first of all, I think we just needed to find the people that really had the passion, and we went through several different facilitators that really did not work out. We struggled with membership. We didn't really know who should be involved, who shouldn't be involved. That was all a large discussion. We struggled with protocols. And I think in the long run, the folks at the Idaho Panhandle National Forest saw that the core of that group was really super interested in doing this. And I got a phone call one day that said, I will give you some money if you will stick with this, Liz. And I was like, oh my goodness. They did. And that's when I called the National Forest Foundation and I said, we need a facilitator. And that was pretty much the start, because once NFF really started becoming involved with us, I think we really got the ground underneath us and we were able to keep moving.
There are some really deep organizational principles we don't have time enough to really explore.
Yeah. But
in the interest of full disclosure, with some of my other community hats on, I have been engaged with the Panhandle Forest Collaborative. And the early days were interesting. It followed that typical pattern of sociological forming, storming, norming, group really finding its meaning. And I think one of the things that helped coalesce that was the careful crafting of a mission and purpose and vision. Could you share some of that with us, Liz?
Sure, and I think we took a long time figuring that out. But our mission is to work with the Idaho Panhandle National Forest, and it is a voluntary process, but we try and Primarily, I'm sorry, we primarily work with the Sandpoint, Priest Lake, and part, like I would say, the northern part of the Coeur d'Alene districts. We want to reduce litigation with projects that are important to our forests. We want to promote sustainable operations in our forests, enhance travel and recreation opportunities. We also want to maintain infrastructure for timber. It's a big part of our area up here. Also, ranching and recreation is huge, and we are very interested in conserving native ecosystems.
Well put. And so,
and that's a lot to be managing. So, it is a reason why you are collaborative. We're going to learn more about how you got together with the National Forest Foundation. But what sort of partners are involved in this group beyond, I'm assuming, foresters, and who else, Liz?
Oh man, we have folks from motorized recreation, non-motorized recreation, timber. We have somebody like me that's pretty much just about everything, community orientated, but I work in the forest, but I also believe in our timber industry around here. We have people who are hydrologists, people who are wildlife biologists. Ben, you can chime in here too, because I'm sure I won't cover them all.
County government, hunter and angler interests. I think other than that, you pretty much covered it. At this point, we have 16 active members on the Panhandle Forest Collaborative.
And there's a good interface with conservation organizations as well as, and you've touched on it a little bit, the various state and federal and county agencies, elected officials who represent, have interest in these decisions, are all present either as voting or non-voting participants.
Yes, and that is another really good point, Phil, that there is a specific protocol to become a member, but we are always welcoming people that want to just be involved. If they want to become a member, there are some rules and regulations, so to speak, but they can just come and be an observer and part of the discussion as well.
And they're all open to the public.
Yes.
So as things got rolling, how did it come about that the National Forest Foundation became engaged?
So when we finally got a few dollars, that's when I actually spoke with one of the gals that I knew at National Forest Foundation. And at that time, they had a specific program, and I think it was called WestCan or something like that. And they came over and they sat down with the core group, so to speak, and really started helping us form our protocols and what we were really trying to aim for. And I just can't even tell people how much the National Forest Foundation has helped us, because they keep us grounded. They help with all of this, the peripheral things, because most of us on the collaborative have outside, this is not our job. This is just our passion that we need to do. But we all have jobs and families, et cetera, on the outside. So having somebody that's always in the middle that we can talk to and communicate with and will bring us together, it's just been huge. Thank you, Ben.
Well, you've mentioned that that's a challenge, to have someone who can keep track of everybody and help manage meetings, et cetera, like this. But what are some of the other challenges that you face with a collaborative group as large as this one?
I think some of the biggest challenges are really membership. We are constantly asking ourselves, who are we missing? Who needs to be at the table that we need to reach out to? I think we've been relatively successful with that, and we get new members pretty much all the time, which is super exciting. But there's always somebody that might be missing, so we try and keep that open-minded or that open-ended. I think the really other big challenge is being taken seriously by some of the agency folks. But I really believe that once they attend one of our meetings, they take us very seriously.
Just to chime into that, I facilitate several collaborative groups, and we here at the National Forest Foundation facilitate more groups nationwide. And I gotta say, the Panhandle Forest Collaborative, in my experience, has had just a stellar relationship with the staff on the Idaho Panhandle National Forest. The Panhandle National Forest staff like bring them in, so that means we get on the ground floor and are able to discuss the ins and outs and basically what the community thinks about where this project is headed or should head.
I think that's one of the challenges of collaborations in general, having participated in several others, and we're going to talk about some of the larger collaborative groups too, but Ben, reflect a little bit more on the value and need for those kinds of relationships, and Liz, maybe chime in too with the evolution of how that really came about on the PFC.
I guess I first think the value of those collaborative relationships, such as the Panhandle Forest Collaborative with the Panhandle National Forest, is, I think the from the Forest Services side, I would say that they see this group as an important group for building social license for the work that they do out there in the woods. No better way than get a bunch of people from a diverse set of backgrounds and interests in our national forest to sit down and hear the Forest Service out on why they need to do this project here and what the need is for that particular project. And then for that community group to be able to reflect back and say, I think you need to expand it or shrink it, or, there's a really important trail here, or, I know the elk use this area at a certain time, so we need to make sure we're not working in the area at that time. And then to, reach out for those community members to then reach out to their friends and family and coworkers and say, hey, this project is going on. It looks like it's going to really help with our wildlife habitat or our fire mitigation, things like that, and build that community support around the project.
Well, it sounds like communication is one of the successes, different groups with different goals, et cetera, different interests learn about one another and hopefully are able to get together on some projects. Are there any examples you have of specific successes?
I think one of our big successes, and just one of them, is what we call the Bottom Canyon Project. And this was when we really, I think, got ground behind us, under our feet, so to speak, in that they took us very seriously. The forest supervisor at the time challenged the PFC to actually write our own alternative for this project. And it was a very, very large area in the Coeur d'Alene district. It was heavily used by recreationists, hunters, etc., and it had a lot of insect and disease problems. So we did. We worked very, very hard to put together an alternative for this particular project with their purpose and needs in mind, obviously. And they chose that alternative to implement the project. There was just a couple of changes that we made collaboratively, and that was probably a four-year endeavor and a lot of field trips. It was super successful, and that we had so many diverse stakeholders that sat at that table and went on those field trips to make this project a success in the public's eye as well as in the forest.
Okay, what were some of the changes you suggested that they implemented that you were happy about?
Well, the one that will always come to mind, and Mike Peterson and I laugh about this because there was a road that the 206 that was right down along a creek bed that they really wanted to move out of that area, and we agreed with that because it was the right thing to do. I don't know. I think, Phil, you can chime in here, but I think it took us at least six or seven field trips to figure out where that road should be relocated because there was an old stand growth in that area. There were a lot of aquatic issues in that area, and we just went back and back and back, and finally, through a lot of negotiation and expertise, we figured out a place to actually put that road that would be better for the stream and for the traveling public that wanted to go through that area.
There were a lot of interests to balance, and it without the field trips, without the collaboration, it would be really easy for folks who'd never been on the ground to fall into ideological camps about a kind of activity being good or bad. And without getting too far into the weeds, they were balancing riparian habitat with the old growth habitat with new road construction, which is often seen in a wholesale blanket way as bad, but in some cases, new road construction may help alleviate other concerns. So without getting on the ground and without getting the expertise of road builders and hydrologists and foresters and riparian habitat specialists and wildlife biologists, you can't really make the best decision. And that was one example. I think one of the big takeaways of that project was how in some ways the Forest Service was timid about its size out of fear of litigation. And the collaborative group actually suggested a larger area for treatment and more activity than the Forest Service would have been comfortable with otherwise. And it had both good for the forest health, it was good for the economy, and it was good for a more comprehensive picture of the environmental impacts and the ways to mitigate those. So it was really a big win around for all of the major interests, recreation, that were present at the table. And it was a good example, I think, of how the agency would have had a hard time getting there without a collaborative group looking at the mutual benefits made by the increase in size.
Very nice. Can you tell us about some of the current projects that Panhandle Forest Collaborative is working on? What's going on now?
Well, at the moment, we have quite a list of projects. I think we've got 8 or 9 that we are currently working on. One of the bigger things that I think is has been a really big success is we participated in what they call the 5-year action plan, and it is very successful. But really, our 5-year action plan is now morphed into more like a 10-year action plan. But with all the circumstances that are going on right now, we know that the schedule of projects that we've been working on is probably going to change. But I'm just kind of going through my head here, and I think, oh my gosh, I think we have probably 11 or 12 different projects that we are currently working on with the Forest Service.
I'd like you to talk about one that I know a bit about. It's the Hughes Meadow Project. And I know about that, Liz and Ben, because one of your collaborators last summer was Trout Unlimited. And I was able to, along with a number of folks from the Trout Unlimited group here in Sandpoint, to understand and visit Hughes Meadow and plant seedlings and just understand why that was an important project.
Well, first of all, you just struck my heart. That is truly one of my best projects personally. Thanks, Julie, for your help out there, by the way. So the Hughes Meadows project is an interesting story. In the 40s, it's a large 420-acre area about 12 miles south of the Canadian border. So it's way up there. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous area. And in the 40s, during World War II, they wanted to make an emergency airstrip out there. So they drained the meadow. It's a wetland meadow. They drained the meadow, basically taking the water out of the native channel and put it into a ditch, a very sterile ditch. And our project was to take that native channel and rewater it and take the ditch and basically make wetland ponds out of it. So where you planted the willows was probably along those wetland ponds. But it's a bull trout stream area, and obviously that's an endangered species that we want to take care of. But more than it's a grizzly bear area, so it's hugely a big wildlife habitat area. And we just wanted to restore that to its native ways.
Yes, and I can tell you that we saw a few tiny trout, young fingerling trout, in some of the ponds when we were there working. And then I had a report from Eric Burnson, who works with the Kootenai tribe, who joined us that day, that they came back a week later to check on the seedlings, and a grizzly bear was sighted in that meadow. So I think it's working.
We had several harrowing experiences with that, but it was very, very fun, and it was so rewarding.
I think a couple other projects of note, and they're in different stages of development. So for the public who's listening and may not have engaged yet with the PFC, address the potential opportunity for not only the collaborative to look at these projects, but the public to engage in them. And what I'm thinking of specifically is the Buckskin Saddle and the Scattered Lands, and they're at different stages of development. So Liz, maybe, or Ben, you could help us understand a little more about each of them and again, what it looks like going forward to work on them.
Sure, maybe I'll start with Scattered Lands. There is this new, I don't know if you want to call it an initiative, within the Forest Service. Basically, the Forest Service is now engaged in what they're calling shared stewardship. And shared stewardship is basically the Forest Service's invitation to the states and to communities to engage directly in the management of our national forests. And in Idaho, the governor and the Forest Service have worked out two priority areas for shared stewardship projects, one in the south and one in the north. And that north one happens to be on the Idaho Panhandle National Forest. And the first project being developed under this shared stewardship initiative is the Scattered Lands Project. And to the best of my knowledge, it's in the earlier stages of development, but the idea is, again, to engage the state and local communities in the active management of those national forests. So that's a real exciting project. Liz, you want to take Buckskin Saddle?
Sure. And Scattered Lands, that's going to be a challenge, I think, but it's going to be exciting because there's an area that does need some forest management. Buckskin Saddle is really interesting. It's over in the Clark Fork area. And so again, as you can see, our geographic spread is pretty wide. But this is a very, very dear area to some people who recreate in the woods, motorized and non-motorized. There's some serious wildlife habitat issues that the Forest Service would like to improve. And there's some aquatics areas, trails that go right through creeks and roads that are right along creeks, etc. What we've done is, outside of our group, is we've tried to bring in the local communities that live in that area, as well as some of the people that recreate in that area, to bring in their ideas, because they have some very serious concerns about their actual homes or the places where they hunt and they fish and they hike, etc. And I think that's been super exciting because sometimes there's perspectives that the Forest Service or even the PFC may not see. So when you bring in those other interests and people that are actually living right there, it really helps out. It hones things a little bit better for the Forest Service on what the public would really like to see take place.
Okay. How does the governor's shared task force on shared stewardship aid your work?
Well, I'd say we're just involved with shared stewardship as a collaborative group. At this point, I don't think it necessarily aids our work, but I guess I'd say that, another component of shared stewardship is the aspect of cross-boundary. So it's not just about working on national forests, but also working on surrounding forests and neighboring forests. I think it aids our work and just the ability to work together and learn how to work together is an important component to moving forward and addressing a lot of the challenges facing forest health and fire risk.
And that's been an interesting thing to see Idaho Department of Lands working with the Forest Service and working with the public, because typically that's not what their mandate has been. And it's so far as I'm concerned, it's been quite successful.
And we've actually had some of that. The Scattered Lands, I think, is the first one under this formal council, but the Shared Stewardship Program, Idaho Department of Lands has assisted with some other projects up around Priest River, Priest Lake, Liz.
That was the Good Neighbor Authority, which was kind of the baby sister of Shared Stewardship. Okay. And there have been a couple projects just north of Priest River here that they've used that in. And it was really hard for some folks to adhere to this new philosophy because they just want their forest to never be touched or whatever. But I think it's been pretty successful in that, to remember that even though the Idaho Department of Lands is participating in this, they still have to go by all the mandates that the Forest Service Agency has to go by. So all of those things like NEPA, et cetera, are all adhered to. That's part of the deal. But it's been able to progress faster because there's more manpower to get things done on the ground. And I think that's been helpful. And I think there's been, again, more perspectives have been brought to the table to see what needs and should be done.
So overall, it sounds like things are working well. And I'd like you to pick up that thread and talk a little bit more about that, and then lead us into how the Panhandle Forest Collaborative work is not in a vacuum. We've touched a little on the governor's panel, but really how it fits into other collaboratives across Idaho in an informal and formal way, the Idaho Forest Restoration Partnership, I'm thinking.
And partnership is the key word, Phil, because there are a number of collaboratives. I think there's 6 or 10 or something in Idaho, and we all have different experiences and we have different landscapes that we're dealing with, but you can always share little tidbits of things that work here, don't work there, or how do you deal with a personality that is disruptive or things like that. And I do think that some of the folks that are working with the Good Neighbor Authority and the Shared Stewardship, they actually come to our meetings, the PFC meetings, number one, to keep us apprised of what's going on, but number two, to find out what are our feelings about what they're trying to do as well. And again, I have this thing about communication, and you really do have to have a way of communicating in a very widespread manner in order to bring these things together. It's not easy, but it's necessary. Did I answer your question, Phil?
I think so. On the whole, then, try to draw us, as we wind down the conversation here, a sense of where the Panhandle Forest Collaborative is at on the scale of how successful you think it's been and maybe where it's going.
Well, I like to think we're super, super successful. But that doesn't mean everything goes right. I think collaborative projects and groups like this they're going to be here forever. Things, we're dynamic. Things change, forests change, communities change, interests change. So I think that there's always going to be something that needs to be brought to the table and have a wide variety of diverse thoughts and actions taking place.
Well put. Well, as we come to an end, Liz, I think it would be important for us to have your contact information again, but also any information about upcoming meetings, if listeners might like to attend one or chat with you.
Ben, I'm going to leave the meeting thing with you, but as far as getting a hold of me, and please do, if anybody has any thoughts or questions, my office is here in Priest River. It's the Priest Community Forest Connection. Phone number is 208-448-0210, or my email is lizjg35@hotmail.com. Contact me anytime.
Okay, and Ben, I'll bet you've got a website or a Facebook page that folks could go to.
Yeah, you can go to the National Forest Foundation's website at www.nationalforests, and that forest is plural, .org. And then once you're there, you can search for Panhandle Forest Collaborative. That'll get you to the Panhandle Forest Collaborative's page. You'll find meeting records there and upcoming meeting dates. Our next meeting is going to be on Wednesday, July 5th. We regularly meet at the Bonner County Administration Building, and we meet every other month. But with the COVID situation, we're not quite sure what's going to happen this month. But if folks want to get a hold of me, they can join the Panhandle Forest Collaborative's mailing list. My email address is birey at nationalforests, and again, that forest is plural, .org, or you can give me a call at 406-830-3369.
So once again, the next meeting is coming up Wednesday, July 15th. Give us some teasers of what's going to be on the table that might be of interest to people who are listening right now.
Well, we're going to be talking about several of the projects that we spoke of earlier, including the Scattered Lands Project, which is kind of a big deal these days. You know, the Panhandle Forest Collaborative has also put in for a national collaboration project called the Collaborative Forest Landscape Restoration Program. And so maybe we'll hear an update. I know back in DC, they were just settling on who's going to be awarded that program or not. So hopefully we'll hear a little bit more about that.
I think we will be hearing about that, Ben, as well as we've got a couple of projects on the ground that we're going to talk about. One's called the Biochar Project. So there's some kind of fun things that we're going to learn about as well.
And again, open to the public. Anyone can come and attend and find out more information through the website contacts listed. And thank you both, Ben and Liz, for joining us today. Really thorough interview. Great topic. It sounds like there's going to be opportunities in the future. We might have to make this a regular segment, checking in as things progress, as new projects are on the radar, and as there's major progress on the ones we've been discussing. So we sure do appreciate, though, you spending some time with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, thanks to both of you. Great to see you all.
You're very welcome. Well, I want to thank you both, Ben Irie, Conservation Connect Program Manager for the National Forest Foundation, and Liz Johnson-Gebhardt, Executive Director of Priest Community Forest Connection and also a co-chair of the Panhandle Forest Collaborative. So for those of you who are just joining us or join midway, you've been listening to KRFY Community Conversations, now held Tuesday mornings at 8 in lieu of our normal live Tuesday morning shows with KRFY. I want to thank you all for listening, and we'll be in touch again next week.